It is Friday, June 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Russian aggression in eastern Ukraine.
They are positioned to launch a new major offensive as opposed to the piecemeal violations that they commit every day.
We'll also look at the race to see who will be the next U.S. president, plus women of country music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Times continue to be tense in Ukraine. VOA's Jeffrey Young has the latest, including some perspective on what's happening.
Ambassador John Herbst is a director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council in Washington. On Thursday, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko told his parliament that the military must prepare to defend themselves against a possible full-scale invasion from Russia. Ambassador Herbst, what do you think of that? Is that rhetoric or is he ringing a fire bell?
There's not been a real ceasefire in Ukraine since the Russian aggression began. The ceasefire that was established, the so-called Minsk II ceasefire on February 15, has been violated daily by the Kremlin and its surrogates in eastern Ukraine. So Ukrainians, over 100 soldiers from Ukraine have died since the ceasefire went into effect. Over the past week or two, we've seen a great increase in violations by the Russians and their agents in eastern Ukraine across the ceasefire line. And it's become even greater in the town of Martienko over the last day or two. The Kremlin has put in, over the past couple of months, substantial increase of advanced weaponry. So they can move, they can thrust more deeply into Ukraine at any moment. Whether or not they will is an open question, but Mr. Poroshenko is right to be prepared for it and to warn that this could happen.
Do you see this as a clear signal that there's action about to take place, or is this just a chess game?
The short answer is we don't know. We do know that the Kremlin has violated the ceasefire from day one. We do know that their violations of the ceasefire have increased over the past week or so, and that they are positioned to launch a new major offensive as opposed to the piecemeal violations that they commit every day. The Kremlin and their boys in Ukraine's east have taken something like 28 towns since the February ceasefire. Whether or not we'll see a large grab for land as opposed to the small ones we've been witnessing over the past 3 months is an open question. But again, Ukraine needs to be prepared for all contingencies.
What should the West be doing at this stage in what's going on to help and support Ukraine? What is needed and what's appropriate?
Well, they should start by being forthright that, in fact, we're seeing an even greater number of violations of the ceasefire by the Kremlin side. But point of fact, the West's response to this crisis has been insufficient. It's been weak. We should be providing Ukraine with defensive weapons so that they can defend their own territory. We should be putting much more in the way of troops and military hardware into the Baltic states and Poland and perhaps Romania, because Mr. Putin has designs on the eastern members of NATO. We want to deter Russian aggression against the NATO countries. We want to stop Kremlin aggression in Ukraine. And the sooner that Western leaders wake up, the better off it will all be.
Ambassador John Herbst is the director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council in Washington. I'm Jeffrey Young, VOA News.
And many thanks to you, Jeff. Now we go to Kramatorsk, Ukraine, where VOA correspondent Daniel Sheriff is preparing to move into pro-Russia rebel-controlled areas such as Donetsk. My colleague Michael Lippin spoke with Daniel.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to take one of the few routes to go into the rebel-held territory, and hopefully there will be at least one of them that we can go through safely, that where there's no reports of fighting and where it has not been closed off by either side. Essentially, you drive down the road and you go through one checkpoint that the Ukrainian side controls, and you show them your identifications that you've registered with the Ukrainian side, and there are a couple of different IDs that you have to have in order to get through the Ukrainian side checkpoint, and then you keep on driving down that road, and eventually you come to the rebel checkpoint, and you show them your IDs. Don't show them the main Ukrainian one because they don't like to see that because it says ATO on it, which stands for anti-terrorism operation, because officially the Ukrainian authorities call them terrorists. So you don't show them that ID, but you show them your other press card, and they hopefully let you through, and then you can apply for the official rebel accreditation once you get into Donetsk city. So that's the plan, and hopefully we can get through all those points without any problem, and emphasize that although I am Voice of America, I'm Voice of America based in Moscow, and hopefully the rebels will not think anything too poorly of VOA, and we'll be able to get through without any problems. Fingers crossed.
And again, the subject of your story that you're hoping to do there?
Well, we're hoping to do several stories there, including, you know, what Ukraine is going to have to do to win back the hearts and minds in the East. Also, what the rebel authorities, self-appointed authorities, are doing to try and establish their own autonomous region within Ukraine, and some of the challenges and efforts that they're making in order to try and set themselves up as a self-governing authority, although they're receiving, of course, a lot of support from Russia. Russia says it's just humanitarian aid, but of course we see all kinds of evidence that there's also a lot of military aid and military weapons and troops being sent in from Russia as well. So it will be interesting to see what we're able to get access to and what we can hear from the rebel side, and see how dependent they've actually become on Russia since they've been cut off from Ukraine to a large degree. That's the industrial heartland of Ukraine, a lot of coal mines, a lot of steel mills, and some of them are still in operation. A lot of their products, though, are, they were going to Russia before, quite a bit of them, but now they can't get as many products to the rest of Ukraine because of the conflict. So there's a lot more dependence on Russia now, and it'll be interesting to see that as well.
That was VOA's Daniel Scherf speaking from Kramatorsk, Ukraine, and with VOA's Michael Lippin, who happens to be sticking around for more on how our audience and what they're saying about the situation in Ukraine. Michael?
Thanks, Steve. You can find Daniel Scherf's latest web report about the situation in Ukraine on our homepage, voanews.com. It's headlined, VOA Witnesses Troops on the Move in Eastern Ukraine. We tweeted the article on our VOA News Twitter account and got a reply from Gerard Pedrico in Jakarta, Indonesia. Pedrico wrote, "It seems that Russia wants to control all of Ukraine, but if that were so, then why didn't Russia put all of its military muscle into it?" That reader's comment reflects some of the uncertainty that exists about just how involved Russia is in the conflict in its smaller neighbor. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko's latest warning of a colossal threat of large-scale fighting in the country's east appears to have boosted the interest of Twitter users in the conflict. Analytics website Topsy shows that the word Ukraine has been tweeted at least 22,000 times in the past day, a level reached only two other times in the past month. One Ukraine tweet getting attention is from U.S. TV network CNN, which links to its latest report with the headline, "Obama Works to Get Europe Behind Him on Ukraine." In that story, CNN White House producer Kevin Liptak talks about President Obama's upcoming meeting with leaders of other Group of Seven world powers in Germany this weekend. Liptak writes that Mr. Obama is expected to urge the European G7 powers to extend economic sanctions on Moscow in retaliation for Russia's alleged military support to the rebels fighting Ukraine's pro-Western government. And Russia, of course, denies any direct military involvement with those rebels. Steve, back to you.
And many thanks to you, Michael. That was VOA's Michael Lippin. Still ahead on International Edition, Nigeria's president pledging to investigate war crimes accusations against Boko Haram. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Nigeria's president has said his government will leave no stone unturned in dealing with all cases of human rights abuses. Follows the release of a shocking report from Amnesty International, which alleges widespread torture, abuse, and killings of more than 8,000 prisoners during the military's offensive against the terror group Boko Haram. Henry Ridgewell has more from London.
Amnesty International gathered dozens of brutal videos and images showing abuses and killings apparently carried out by the Nigerian armed forces. In some, prisoners are beaten to death. In others, they are shot and thrown into open graves. Amnesty interviewed more than 400 victims, eyewitnesses, and senior members of the security forces. Most of the prisoner deaths occurred during detention, says Amnesty's Daniel Eyre.
We found that more than 7,000 people have died in military custody in northeast Nigeria in some of the most appalling conditions imaginable. They died of starvation, of thirst, as a result of lack of access to medical care. Many were tortured.
Amnesty's evidence also points to the widespread extrajudicial killing of prisoners. Some were hung on poles and suspended over fires. Others were thrown into pits, had their throats cut, or were shot.
More than 1,200 men and boys were unlawfully killed by the Nigerian military. That includes cases like what happened after the Giwa Barracks attack, where more than 640 recaptured detainees were executed in one day. And our report shows that the people at the top of the Nigerian military knew about these crimes and didn't take action to stop them.
Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari gave his first reaction to the report on Twitter, saying his administration will leave no stone unturned, in his words, to promote the rule of law and deal with all cases of human rights abuses. On a visit Wednesday to neighbouring Niger to discuss Boko Haram, Mr. Buhari pledged a new strategy to fight the terror group. President Buhari said he renewed his commitment to chase Boko Haram up to its last trenches to obliterate it. 5 years of the evil presence of this sect is enough, he said, adding that Nigerian soldiers have suffered a lot of defeats, but it is not the moment to criticize. Furthermore, he said, we are going to mobilize our best forces to attack this sect. The Amnesty report names five senior officers who it says should face investigation. But Nigeria's Director of Defense Information, Major General Chris Olukolade, accused Amnesty of trying to blackmail the military and said the officers accused had no reason to indulge in the allegation made against them. But the evidence is compelling, says Daniel Eyre.
In fact, at one point they commissioned a report which showed the appalling conditions in detention, the disease that was causing these deaths. And yet they didn't take action to put an end to these deaths. And that's why we're saying they need to be investigated for their responsibility.
The United States, which had strained ties with President Buhari's predecessor, Goodluck Jonathan, has signaled its readiness to expand military cooperation in the fight against Boko Haram. But analysts say Nigeria's Western allies will want the allegations of war crimes to be fully investigated. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is VOA's International Edition. Almost every day we have news that another candidate has decided to run for U.S. president. Thursday was no exception, as we hear from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone, who speaks with my colleague Sarah Williams.
In fact, former Texas Governor Rick Perry has decided to make a second run for the White House. He tried 4 years ago. His campaign somewhat imploded, especially during a debate when he forgot one of the government departments he wanted to eliminate. But Rick Perry's entrance into the race on the Republican side would make 10 officially declared Republican candidates. And we expect more to come in the weeks ahead, including former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, probably by the middle of this month. Jeb Bush has been seen as a leading contender, but the polls of late show sort of three Republicans bunched at the top of the polls: Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, who is sort of a Bush ally in the past, and former Governor Bush. They're sort of at the top, but a lot of other Republicans are not that far behind in the polls, so that's a wide-open race right now.
Why are there so many running, though? Because a lot of these people, they're not going to be serious contenders, really.
Right. I mean, a couple of reasons. First of all, I think Republicans see the nomination as wide open at this point. So there's no reason not to get in. Maybe lightning, you catch it in a bottle. Maybe you can build on that. It's happened in the past. There's no sort of Mitt Romney-type figure who is sort of expecting his or her turn as the nominee. And so that's led to quite a variety of contenders. And the Republican Party is split up into a lot of different factions: conservatives, foreign policy hawks, Tea Party, social conservatives. That allows various candidates to kind of pick a building block and try to use that to gain momentum in the primaries and caucuses early next year. Certainly, a lot of people have been looking at Jeb Bush's fundraising prowess, which is impressive. But on the other hand, a lot of people are saying he's just not caught fire yet. And I think part of the calculations on the Bush campaign is maybe to move up that announcement, to get in the race now, see if he can restart the fire about his possible candidacy.
Well, the other two leading candidates in the Republican race that you mentioned, because certainly Bush is a very well-known name and connections and fundraising abilities from his family, but Senator Rubio as well as Governor Walker, why have those two gone further in the race so far?
Both have made good impressions early at various candidate forums around the country, especially with conservatives. Rubio places a lot of emphasis on foreign policy. It's become a huge issue, by the way, in this early stage of the campaign. A lot of focus on ISIL, the threat from the Islamic State, Rubio and several others taking a very strong stand on that, wanting a more aggressive campaign. But then you get someone like Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, who got a lot of attention during the recent Patriot Act debate in the Senate, taking a different view, wanting to keep the country out of foreign wars. So that'll be an active debate on the Republican side. Walker's an interesting character. He gained a lot of national attention. He took on unions in his home state of Wisconsin, has a lot of strong followers among conservatives, someone they believe a governor who's done well, who won re-election and now could appeal to a wider swath of voters. But he is untested, and that's what this primary process is all about, and we're going to see that roll out now for more than a year.
Well, and looking at the Democrats, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is no doubt the front runner, but you also have Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, as well as former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley are running, and I believe as well former Rhode Island Senator Lincoln Chafee has also announced. Do these Democrats, other than Hillary Clinton, stand much of a chance?
A lot of the experts say no at this point, but they will note that Hillary Clinton's approval ratings, especially on issues like trust, personal accountability and responsibility, have come down a bit through the various sort of controversies we've seen reported on in recent months, the email, the Benghazi attacks, and so forth. But no, the challengers we're looking at, Lincoln Chafee, Martin O'Malley, Bernie Sanders, none of them has a national following. It doesn't mean someone can't catch on. And right now, there's probably a lot of buzz about Sanders, who's older than Hillary Clinton, makes her look younger, which I'm sure the Clinton people don't mind. But this sort of self-described socialist Democrat with this focus on income inequality, which has become an issue in the country, I think he's likely to get some buzz among progressives, the very liberal portions of the Democratic Party. They take on a bigger role in the primary process. They're the ones who tend to come out and vote. So in that sense, Sanders could try to appeal to them. But Hillary Clinton still looks very strong in terms of just winning the nomination right now. But there's going to be some debate there, and she will have to defend her policies. She will have to come out front and be more aggressive. And some of them, like Lincoln Chafee, are actually focusing on her foreign policy record. Chafee was the only Republican in the Senate to vote against the authorization of the Iraq War. So it's an interesting sort of foundation for his campaign. And again, we will have debates on the Democratic side, and Hillary Clinton will be put to the test.
Okay. Thank you, Jim.
You bet.
That is VOA National Correspondent Jim Malone speaking with my colleague, Sarah Williams.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's premier newsmaker interview program. If you have ideas for guests or topics, or want to comment on one of our programs, please write to us at Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the internet, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is pcusa@voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
And now here's VOA's David Byrd with a look at what's happening in the world of music.
If you've listened to country radio any time in the past few years, you've probably heard the names of Dierks Bentley, Brad Paisley, Darius Rucker, Lee Bryce, Luke Bryan, Kenny Chesney, Jason Aldean, of course. But what you might not have heard is too many women's names. That's a problem, at least according to some of the ladies of country. But consultant Keith Hill doesn't think so. To talk about this, I'm joined by Nikki Strong. Nikki, welcome.
How are you doing?
I am well. I am well. I did that little rundown there of the artists because
yes.
that's the guys that played when I was coming to work.
Yes.
It's in about a 45-minute time period.
Mm-hmm.
It was the only female voices I heard were from Lady Antebellum and from Little Big Town. But as far as solo female artists, there aren't that many being played on country radio.
No.
And this guy, Keith Hill, who's supposedly a big guru in country programming,
right.
has set off a bit of a storm. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, he was interviewed and he talked about that if you want to win in the ratings game in country radio, take the women out.
Uh-oh.
He pretty much said, you know, the meat of country music is pretty much bro music. It's all the guys.
Right.
Women are like tomatoes.
So we're talking guys like Luke Bryan, Blake Shelton,
exactly.
Kenny Chesney,
yes.
Jason Aldean, of course.
Oh, yes, Jason, who are all on the charts right now.
Right.
But it caused a real big firestorm among a lot of artists, particularly women artists. Miranda Lambert was one of the most outspoken.
Mm.
She made an excellent point. She said it's very dangerous to say that. She said because, first of all, it reduces women in their contribution, number one. She said also it makes women less valuable. So it makes labels less willing to sign women country artists,
right.
makes them less willing to put resources behind them, good writers, good producers, and they feel like they're not going to make well on their investment. And when you have consultants like Mr. Hill, who are consulting radio stations
right.
and who are making these major decisions, he's impacting the bottom line for a lot of women, a lot of households. And this mentality of don't play too many women on music, it's not just across country, it's across other genres as well.
Hmm.
And I know part of it dates back to when women, really, they were only like 10% of the artists that were played on radio.
Right.
So consultants would say, spread them out. But during the course of the years and under the game of telephone, it became don't put two women back to back because it'll alienate your female listeners. So he also talked about when he does research that a lot of women, when they do research, will turn away when there's too many women artists. But there are other consultants that disagree with him as well.
And see, nobody says don't put two guys back to back.
Exactly.
So that formula
exactly.
doesn't hold.
And they don't say, oh, well, if women don't, you know, listen to the guys, don't play them back to back.
Right.
They just get rid of that song.
Right. Exactly. See, I would think it would be a function of is it a good song, regardless
right.
of who sings it.
Right. Right. And some people were saying that, you know, as you have more female country artists trying to do like the pop thing, that's not going to work either.
Mm.
But again, it gets dangerous if you feel like, okay, I have a woman artist, I have to do what's been proven.
Uh-huh.
I have to try and Taylor Swift her,
mm-hmm.
you know, as opposed to really developing her voice.
We'd love to hear your opinion about this. You can post it on our Facebook page. That's VOA Music. You can also post a comment on Nikki's show, Country Hits USA. That's at voanews.com.
Follow your arrow wherever it points at. Follow your arrow.
yeah, don't forget to follow your arrow wherever it points. What do you think that means? Huh? Well, we'll find out. Stephen Colbert, who takes over for retired longtime CBS Late Show host David Letterman, has been pressured of late to name his band leader for the new show, which starts on September the 8th.
Hi, I'm Stephen Colbert down in New Orleans, Louisiana, and people keep asking me who my band leader is going to be. Well, I like this guy.
Hi, I'm John Batiste.
Yeah, if you don't know this guy, you got to check him out. He's all over YouTube. John Batiste is a singer, an educator from New Orleans who's been touring globally with his band that's called Stay Human. He's collaborated with performers including Prince, Wynton Marsalis, Lenny Kravitz, many more. He studied at Juilliard School in New York, prestigious school. He received his undergraduate degree there, his master's degree. He is synonymous with New Orleans. His music represents what makes that southern U.S. city so popular among music lovers. I'm one of them. Hey, listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. We hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United Nations Security Council has unanimously adopted a resolution calling on member states and all parties to armed conflict to protect journalists in conflict zones and elsewhere. The resolution declared that the work of a free and independent media is essential to a democratic society and called on states to ensure there is accountability for crimes against media personnel in armed conflict and to respect the right of journalists everywhere to exercise their profession without intimidation. Resolution 2222 was adopted as the violence against journalists worldwide continues to rise, including summary executions, kidnappings, and imprisonment. Speaking to the Security Council, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power highlighted the case of Mazen Darwish, head of the Syrian Center for Media and Freedom of Expression, which reported on the atrocities committed by the Assad regime. Mr. Darwish and his two colleagues, Hani Zitani and Hussein Garir, were arrested and imprisoned by regime authorities in 2012. Their trial has been suspended 24 times. Ambassador Power noted that it is not only in conflict zones that journalists are in danger.
Look to any region and you will see alarming warning signs of how the crackdown on press freedom is coupled with a broader crackdown on civil and political rights.
Her examples included the imprisonment in Ethiopia of 9 journalists, including 6 bloggers from the Collective Zone 9, who have been behind bars since April 2014, charged under Ethiopia's anti-terrorism proclamation. Ambassador Power noted that for every journalist or group targeted through prosecution, attacks, and threats, countless more are impacted, self-censoring, hiding, or fleeing countries that desperately need their independent voices. With Resolution 2222, the international community has underlined the need to protect journalists and the right to free expression, insisting that states and other groups who violate this right be held accountable. It is now the responsibility of all to move from affirmation to implementation of this crucial principle.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.